did you miss me? Y'all don't be missing me for real. Nobody ever messages. Nobody ever calls. No, I'm just joking. I've actually been getting an outpour of support recently. And I'm overwhelmed. I love it. I appreciate it. I needs it. Gots to have it. Welcome to I Swear to Drunk, I'm Not God. How are you? I hope you all had a wonderful week. You know, I hope it's good. I'm by my lonesome again. I got my baby Luna sitting over here. She's knocked the fuck out, which is perfect. Gives me an opportunity to finish this episode because she's going to have to boo-boo later. So we're back. This is episode 11 of season 2. And we got 9 more episodes left, bitches. I am going to take a break. I don't know when I'm going to take it yet. I think I said May before. You know, I think it's going to be May. Then I'm going to the Caribbean in June. So I may take a break in middle of May so I could be off for a full month. So I'll be off until the middle of June. I don't know. This is like stream of consciousness right now. I don't know. Haven't really decided. But I appreciate you right here, right now. Let's stay present. We'll stay present. All right. So this is episode 11. You have no idea who we're talking about. And I would also like to say that this was actually a listener request. I have a new friend by the name of A.D. Rayford. I will not give you his real name because he didn't ask for that. And he doesn't know that I'm doing this right now. But I want to thank him because he gave me this topic that I'm going to talk to you about today. He messaged me a couple of weeks ago. He was listening to the Thelma Todd episode and felt that there was another Hollywood starlet that he would like for me to explore. So I decided to do that. Today we're going to talk about the mysterious disappearance of Jean Spangler, and you haven't heard of her, so I'm not even going to ask because I haven't heard of her and I went to fucking film school. You hear me? And then what's the poison? The poison today is the white lady, because Jean Spangler was indeed a white lady. If you listen to me regularly, you probably heard of this cocktail before. The last time I mentioned this cocktail was on an episode I did with Sal this season, actually, and we didn't have an opportunity to drink it. That episode was the episode on the Toy Box Killer. Go back, listen to it. It was great. But I'm actually having it today, and it's lovely. It's lovely. If you like whiskey sours, egg white whiskey sours, you may actually like the white lady. It's so funny to say that. It feels interesting. It's basically egg white, 2 ounces of gin, a half ounce of lemon juice, and a half ounce of Cointreau, the old triple sec. You shake it, you dry shake it first for 30 seconds, and then you shake it with ice until it's chilled, and then you pour it. And then you have yourself a white lady. Yes, enjoy it. I'm going to sip mine. Mine is very pretty, too, because I used Empress, so it's kind of purple. Mine is more like a purple lady. But it's so frothy from all the egg white that I can see how it could just like turn white. Okay. So today we're going to talk about the mysterious disappearance of Jean Spangler. Now, I'm going to preface this by saying that this is going to be another very Hollywood-y type of topic. It takes place in the 1940s. It should be very fun to explore this. Think of this, like I said before, as a game of Clue. Because unfortunately, this is an unsolved mystery. For this episode, I read The Disappearance of Jean Spangler, the history of one of Hollywood's most enduring unsolved mysteries. Very interesting book, very short book. This will be a short episode. You know, honestly, I miss doing my 2-hour episodes. I don't know how you all feel about it. You know, this hour and a half shit is not really hitting. And I also miss doing episodes with people. I'll bring some guests back. But, you know, I've been on between the audit and, you know, just me just like, okay, fuck it. Let me do it. You know, just trying to get it done. Plus, I'm spending a lot of time on TikTok. I got to wrangle that in a little bit. I've been doing lives recently, and it's actually been an enjoyable experience. Also, I want to shout out a website. What's the website, you may be asking? The website is a website called feedspot.com. They actually sent me an email on Tuesday, which would be yesterday. And they told me that I Swear to Drunk I Am Not God has been selected by our panelists as one of the top 80 inappropriate podcasts on the fucking web. If I had an applause button, I would fucking hit it. I would hit it. You hear me? Apparently, my host sends out the podcast to different sites and they, you know, sometimes they get ranked and things like that and they show up in spaces. And I Swear to Drunk I Am Not God was number fucking 20. I was top 20 in inappropriate podcasts on the web, and I love every minute of it. They personally gave me a high five and they wanted to thank me for my contribution to this world. It's the most comprehensive list of top 80 inappropriate podcasts on the internet, and they are honored to have me as a part of it. So I'm forever grateful. I love it. You know, I'm going to keep bragging about it. A part of this podcast to me, and this is why this is important, because I feel like a lot of people didn't really know if I should be excited about this or not. And I am, because a part of I Swear to Drunk I'm Not God was to celebrate debauchery, not just from the true crime standpoint, but also from the standpoint of I am a walking, talking fucking mess. Like I, excuse me, Jesus, sorry. I've been in a rain today. I'm sorry. Plus I also had a massage today. So I had my sinus pressure points in my chest massaged, and I'm like very phlegmy. So I apologize. But if you listen to this episode, you should be used to it by now. I'm always hocking up, but I appreciate that so very much, because that's an important designation for me. You know, like people, if you live a lifestyle of being yourself, you appreciate every now and again being called inappropriate. And I don't shun that title primarily because I enjoy being truthful. And sometimes the truth can be inappropriate. I enjoy being fun and wild, and just like, I enjoy being a hedonist. Then sometimes that's looked at as inappropriate. I enjoy alcohol, and I enjoy sex, and I enjoy true crime, and I enjoy, you know, Hollywood and all that other shit. And that is all, in a way, inappropriate. So, sip. I think it's safe to say that I'm a little bit of a wild man. Why not just call myself a man? I'm a little wild. I'm starting to accept that about myself, and I just love it. You know, I'm learning to appreciate that part of myself. So I'm forever grateful. So between AD Rafer giving me this wonderful fucking topic, to FeedSpot putting me on a list of 80 people and saying that I am 20. You know what I mean? Like, next year we gotta be number one. You know what I mean? Like, so what else? No, I'm just joking. But I love the privilege of being able to use my voice, even if it reaches a small audience and people find me funny. People may find it disgusting. People may find it too much or whatever. But I also love being that person that truly doesn't give a fuck. You know, this is I Swear to Drunk I'm Not God. There's even a little bit of messiness in the title. So if you came here expecting, you know, holier than thou behavior from me, my friends, or my sister, or, you know, even these stories, you've just come to the wrong place. It's just, you're not going to find it here. Where what we do here is we get drunk while we listen and tell terrible stories. And every now and again, we inject our personal life into it, and you get to know me a little bit better. Every now and again, my friends inject their personal lives into it, and you get to learn them a little bit better. So I'm very appreciative of being a part of that list. That actually made my fucking day yesterday. Like, if I had to pick a moment, that was the moment, because I've been doing this since October of 2022. And while I don't make money off of it, it makes me feel tingly inside to know that somewhere people are listening to me and hearing my voice, and they know that I take it seriously. and I'm consistent and that I don't fuck around. You know what I mean? So I'm going to sip to that again. This white lady is fire. This is one of those drinks that like I'm like low key scared to go to a bar and be like, hey, can I have a white lady? And they'll be like, OK, she's in the back. I'm not that wild. Come on now. Come on, guys. Relax. Everybody relax. But like I was saying, too, I've been pissing around on live and it has been very fun. You know, it's been very fun. I've, you know, haphazardly run into very interesting people and had conversations with people and with, you know, being on live the way I've been on live, I think I will accidentally slip into some new listeners, which is, you know, ultimately the goal. So I am grateful to be a part of that platform as well. Please don't ban TikTok. TikTok is wonderful. You know, I would like to say that I find TikTok wonderful. I was talking about this with my therapist because I firmly believe that TikTok is a lovely space where you gain access to so many insightful people. Like, don't get me wrong. There are idiots on there, but there are idiots everywhere. There are idiots on the street. There are idiots at your job. There are idiots in the hospital. There are idiots in school. There are idiots everywhere. But there's an aspect of TikTok that is incredibly liberating that I think it goes without saying, but at the same time, to people who are so anti-TikTok, they don't engage in the actual the social media aspect of it enough to truly understand how it feels being a part of that platform. Because it is a different feeling. It's much different than Instagram. You know, I mean, honestly, I truly feel like TikTok is, even though they have a lot of things that they don't allow you to say and a lot of music they won't allow you to play and a lot of things that they suppress and things like that, they do try to control the environment. But there's still a lot of things and a lot of people who are able to display their truest selves on that app and have other people see it in a real way and not just see it because they pay for promotion or not just see it because they, you know, put in some complicated ass algorithm. It's like, no, we're going to push it to a certain number of people regardless. And your consistency, the type of content that you create is going to eventually reach a larger audience. You just have to be patient. So I enjoy organic engagement. So right now I just hop on live every now and again to engage with people. And I enjoy it. I think it's dope. So I got a few friends I can thank for that. People have been telling me to do it for years and I've kind of ignored it because I was on that bandwagon for a minute. Like, what the fuck is this shit? You know what I mean? But then once you're on it, it's odd. It oddly starts to feel like a community. Like, it really does. It feels like what Facebook should have been once it left the college realm. You know what I'm saying? So I'm going to sip again because I hope they don't ban TikTok because I love that fucking app. If you want to find me on TikTok, I'm on there. Sting like a bee. B-E-A as in B. Arthur, not bzz, the bee. I love that shit. So we're going to leave it there. You want to learn a little bit more about me? You can find me over there because I act a fucking fool on TikTok. And also, I just, you know, you learn how to control the environment a little bit, you know, take the negative people, destroy them the way you want to. But then also, you know, you have some people who just fuck with you and you'll probably never meet in your life. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, if I can get 5 people, you know, a month to listen to my podcast, it's totally worth it. And my way of doing that, too, is to have people engage with me first. And then, you know, they were like, oh, shit, I listen to true crime, too. That's what I prefer than to be like, oh, I'm just going to shove my podcast down your throat because I want you to listen to it. Oh, so bad. You know, I don't do this for a living, so I don't rely on that. I don't do it for that purpose. That's not the explicit purpose. I also didn't necessarily plan on doing I Swear to Drunk I'm Not God to become successful from it. I work in television. Shit, I'm gainfully employed. I wasn't necessarily, you know, like, this is a retirement plan. This was just something to do. You know what I mean? Like, it was just a hobby. And so it's a hobby that I enjoy. Some motherfuckers knit and it turns into them knitting sweaters and fucking, you know, cat hats. I don't know. That felt right. But to me, like, this is just like I can exercise this muscle mentally and emotionally, and I can also gain some recognition for it and appreciation and, you know, have people pour into me. You know, so I could pour into other people. So I'm just delighted right now. Two or four or five, I don't know where I am on the bullet list, but I'm also, my show got picked up. I'm possibly on track to be promoted. My sister is working with Forrest Whitaker. He personally invited her to New York to do a Godfather of Harlem. My mom is working on a show with Keanu Reeves. So things are just kind of just like rolling, and I'm just trying to like bask in that gooey goodness of like it rolling. The only thing I'm missing is penis, but sip to that. This is why I'm the most 20th inappropriate podcast. Okay. Oh, excuse me. Let me clear my throat. That was disgusting. Massages are crazy, man. Like massages will start moving all types of fluids. Let me drink some water and we can do this. Let's talk about Spangler. This Topo Chico makes my stomach hurt sometimes. All right. Excuse me. As per usual, we're going to start from the very beginning. Now, Jean Elizabeth Spangler was born on September 2nd, 1923. She was an American actress, by the way. She gained her notoriety because of this mysterious disappearance in 1949. But she was September 2nd, 1923. So that would make her a Virgo. She was born in Seattle, Washington to Cecil Martin and Florence Matilda Spangler. She was one of four. Her brothers were Richard, Edward, and Betsy. I said her brothers. She had brothers, Richard and Edward, and then she had a sister, Betsy. Sorry. Betsy was not a boy. Sorry, I'm sipping. Jesus Christ. In Jean's early years, her family relocated to Los Angeles, where she attended L.A. Franklin High School. And by her graduation in 1941, she wanted to be in the business. It's like, duh. While attempting to break into the business, Spangler was able to network and meet a lot of influential people. That same year, she began a little modeling career in a department store and had a lot of other beauty gigs. I mean, she loved meeting new people. She loved the idea of meeting rich people specifically. And her colleagues said that she always had a plan to get rich and famous, but not on her own merit, but through a partner, which, sip to that. She was determined. She kept her standards high, choosing to never settle for just anything. Her life was not as lush as Thelma Todd's. If you go back in my episodes, you will see that I did an episode on Thelma Todd. Thelma Todd was also a Hollywood starlet, but she was actually like a true Hollywood starlet. Like, she was famous, and this was during the silent film era. And so Jean's life wasn't like Thelma Todd's. Jean was struggling. She was struggling to find that superstar role. But what she did find, it worked for a while. She was described as sultry and big-eyed. She would take small parts in movies. Right out of high school, she was able to land a job as a dancer at Earl Carroll's Theater in Hollywood. Now, this school was great for aspiring Vegas showgirls. Fellow dancers would later say that Spangler was perfectly suited for making the most of it, which, respect, okay? Respect. Because, you know, I always say comparison is a thief of joy, because it is. And I have fallen victim to this myself in the past. And in my present life, I try very hard to not compare myself to other people. I try my very best to not compare my relationships to other people's relationships. I try not to compare myself to other women and their bodies and their hair and their this and how they behave. I try not to compare men to other men. I really do. Now, don't get me wrong, there are such things as generalizations. We as human beings, we sometimes lump people in boxes and we categorize a bunch of people as one thing. And that's just natural. That's just going to happen. But to me, you got to make the most of it, right? Like we're not really here for that long. So to, you know, spend all this time being just like tirelessly fucking exhausted because you're trying so hard to achieve. And it's like, achieve what? Bragging rights? The fuck are you trying to do? You know, like if there was something, let's say you were like, I want this job so I can make money, so I could travel more, because I feel like my soul would be fed if I were able to travel at least once or twice a year. That's a goal. You know what I mean? That's not you comparing yourself to other people. But then, you know, you have to like seize opportunities and also notice an opportunity when it slaps you in the face and know and be smart and intuitive enough to actually take it. But then when things aren't going the way you feel like they should go, you should probably just make the most of it. What can you do right now? Like right now, like if you wanted to go on a trip, let's say you wanted to go to Bali. But you can't make it to Bali. Maybe you can't afford Bali. Maybe you can't take the time off for Bali. Then where could you go that's more local? You know, make adjustments. One of my favorite things to say these days, you got to pivot. That's just how I feel about everything right now. You know, it's like when I was on live, I kind of went back and forth with this guy because he asked me about whether or not I was having children. And people have, you know, asked me if I'm, you know, single and shit like that. And I keep telling people, yes, I'm single and happy. I'm single and happy. And people keep saying, well, you know, well, you should be this or you should be that. If I got caught up in trying to figure out how not to be single, I won't be able to think about anything else. And the moment I've decided to stop thinking about it, that's when I noticed things starting to shift. I was talking about this with my therapist today. Sometimes things happen to you when you're not focused on it. You know, like if my person exists in my lifetime, he will show the fuck up. Penis has always popped itself up in my life. If there is a person who wants to fuck me, and he will one day show up, I'm not going to beg anybody for it and I'm not going to pursue it. I'm tired. I got other shit to do. You know, I found myself just trying to figure out too many ways to like not be lonely and shit. And that shit is, it's exhausting. Like, it's fucking exhausting. Trying to figure out how to spend time with people that don't want to spend time with you. Trying to figure out how to sleep with people that are not available to you. Trying to figure out how to do this and do this and do that. And I'm like, I got to make the most of what I got right here. Like, I can't worry about 5 years from now. Somebody on live, it was like, well, who's going to take care of you when you old? Like the friends that I have, we already talked about having a good girl's, the golden girl's house. Like we just going to take care of ourselves. Why y'all make it seem like having kids means it's a fucking retirement plan? And why would you want to put that on your kids? You call me selfish. That shit is selfish as fuck. I'm sipping to that. I'm getting tipsy, but let me get back on topic. So, Spangler's dancers would later say that Spangler was perfectly suited for making the most of it. She worked tirelessly, almost nonstop, and she never sat still. The career track was better suited for meeting a rich man. She met men with money nightly, and she was dating men from LA to Palm Springs. Now, I do want to pause on this because I think it's important to note before everybody get into the patriarchal brain pattern. Women back then who were kind of not put in a position to take care of themselves had no choice but to do shit like this. And while you could find a man that works at Ford or works at fucking General Motors or some shit like that. You know, if you wanted a glamour lifestyle, what you had to do was find a man that was rich. And there's no problem with wanting a glamorous lifestyle. Back then, that was normal for these women to be on track to find men that could support them, that could take care of them, and not to be able to take care of themselves, because there were so many people in power positions that would have never put women in those roles. You know, so before you go into this story judging her because she was only looking to meet a rich man, women at that time were surviving off of men. What level of survival are you okay with? Are you the woman who's okay with dating the firefighter, dating the police officer, dating the teacher, dating the factory worker, dating the construction worker? Or are you the type of woman that wants to date the Hollywood executive? Are you the type of woman who's a socialite who wants to be the partier and throwing the parties and doing all this other shit? That's what these women were doing. They were trying to figure out, how am I going to survive in a society that won't let me have my own shit? And if that means that I got to go on 52 fucking dates from L.A. to, you know, Palm Springs, then so be it. Now, in 1942, at 19 years old, she was a dancer with Earl Carroll, like I said, and she married a man named Dexter Benner. Now, Dexter Benner was actually a plastic manufacturer, and he was actually pretty fucking rich. Benner, he wasn't necessarily a fan of the dancer's life, even though he was a regular at the club. See, this shit like that pisses me off, because it's like, oh, I'm not a fan of you being a dancer. You know how you meet that guy who's like, I'm going to try to get you out of here. It was like, who says she didn't enjoy her job? You know, well, with that being said, their marriage was almost immediately strained. Then Jean got pregnant and she had Christine on April 22nd, 1944. And I'm sorry, I alternate between Jean and Spangler, but it's Jean Spangler. Now, this didn't slow her down, right? Having a kid. While Benner was serving overseas, Spangler, she was outside. She had many affairs, but one more well-known was this guy by the name of Lieutenant Scotty. That was his nickname. Now, he was very abusive. This would lead to Spangler showing up at work with like black eyes and bruises and shit. He had also threatened to kill her if she left him. So he was a dickhead. When Benner got home, Spangler and Lieutenant Scotty had spent all of their money in the family account and had crashed the car. Now, hear me out. We could play devil's advocate with this. We could say that this fucking bitch, she spent this man's money and she had an affair. But we also already set the tone for who Lieutenant Scotty is. And he's a nut. There's a likelihood that she was forced to do all of this shit. So I'm just putting a pin in this type of shit, because I know how some people think, and I don't want to go into this ridiculing her for any decision she made. I also want to set the stage for what society was like back then. And it wasn't all that friendly to women. And it was also very, domestic violence was also very open in some environments. And so I think that that's, imperative to say. Now, 6 months after they were married, Spangler and Benner, they started the divorce proceedings and they were citing cruelty. So clearly they were having their own issues. Now, they would go off and they would see each other, Benner and Spangler. Who knows in what capacity? But in 1946, after 4 years of marriage and 3.5 years after filing, they finalized the divorce. So it took them a while to get divorced. They were probably fucking around, you know. That happens. Now, the custody battle for Christine lasted 2 years and it was very messy. Benner claimed that Spangler abandoned their daughter and that she was indeed unfit. Now, Benner even told her that he would fix it, quote, fix it, so you'll never see her. Now, I'm putting a pin in that because I don't have a lot of information here. And I don't have a lot of information on what type of woman Jean Spangler was. And I don't have a lot of information on what type of man that Benner was. Again, the 40s. Fix it so you'll never see her could simply mean he was upset that he was off at war, sacrificing his life for his country, and his wife was fucking around with another person, and then drained the family account and also crashed the car, you know, resulting in him having to spend some motherfucking money. I can see that, you know, I can see that. I can see it being like very vengeful in his capacity. Like, fuck you, bitch. Like, you'll never see your daughter again. I could also see Spangler being a little reckless. I mean, she's trying to be a Hollywood socialite. She's trying to find rich men. Who knows? I mean, she could have been one of those mothers who was like, all right, whatever, fuck you. Like, I only had this baby because I wanted to be married to you. So keep it in mind that as I'm speaking, I know what the possibilities are for both Jean and for her ex-husband. But I'm also taking into account the socioeconomic, sociopolitical climate as well. Now, when Benner was awarded custody, he refused to let Spangler see the child on 23 separate occasions, which fueled Spangler's subsequent appeal to regain guardianship. His attempt to coin her as a, quote, glamour girl didn't really work well in court because most of the women working in L.A. were glamour girls. But they were also mothers, and that didn't make them unfit parents. I thought that that was very interesting that the judge said that, because the judge actually is the one that made that statement, because he was kind of like, nigga, this is Hollywood. Yeah, like, every girl's a glamour girl. You can't take away, you know, if that was grounds to take away custody from a mother, then we would take it from every mother in Los Angeles. That's not an excuse. There's a lot of women who work in bars, work in clubs, work in restaurants, as this, working, you know, working on stage, working as actresses, and they're scantily clad, wearing leotards and tights and playing in a cabaret and all the shit that you enjoy on a fucking Friday night, by the way. You know, they're mothers too. That doesn't make them unfit parents. So I thought that the judge was kind of woke for saying that. And that was in 1948. Now, that same year, custody was awarded to Spangler, who eventually moved in, because of course, the mother always gets custody for the most part. The custody was awarded to Spangler. She eventually moved in with her mother, her brother, and her sister-in-law. Her brother would eventually be killed in action in 1945. Now, Spangler was a fucking hustler. She worked in several venues between LA, Vegas, and Palm Springs. But then she started picking up bits in different films, which led her into the Screen Extras Guild. Now, the Screen Extras Guild, also known as SAG, was a labor union representing background performers, extras, in the film industry during the 1940s and beyond. It was established in 1945 in LA in response to the need for better working conditions, pay, and representation for extras who were often subjected to long hours and low wages. And to this day, extras really don't get paid. Shit, I can say that straight up. Now, the SAG negotiated contracts with the film studios on behalf of its members to establish standardized rates of pay, working conditions, and other benefits. Now, this was important in the industry where often extras were working irregular hours and they were faced with uncertain employment conditions. And the guild played a significant role in improving the working conditions and the rights of the background performers in Hollywood during the mid-20th century. Now, it later merged with SAG, the Screen Actors Guild, in 1992, becoming a part of SAG-AFTRA, which is the major labor union representing actors and other professionals in the entertainment industry. Now, to support her child and her sick father, she worked a lot in television, as well as on shows. She worked on shows like The Three Stooges. In 1949, a friend recalled that Jean was pregnant again. Now, Jean was 3 months pregnant again, which hasn't been verified kind of to this day. It's not even known if she went to see a doctor for any prenatal care. She had also been talking to another person about a plan to come into a large sum of money, which to the friend sounded a lot like extortion. And it didn't really sound like a generous monetary gift from a lover. And boy, did she have many fucking lovers. A former attorney said that Spangler must have dated 50 men in 3 months. We gonna sip to that. That's a lot. She was dating men from all backgrounds and all lifestyles, including Ronald Reagan. This is when he was an actor, of course. Mickey Cohen, who was a notorious American gangster who operated in L.A. during the mid 20th century. He rose to prominence in organized crime, particularly in like illegal gambling and extortion. He was succeeding Bugsy Siegel after Siegel was killed in 1947. And then Cohen's criminal empire spanned various illegal enterprises until his conviction for income tax evasion in 1951. So clearly he learned zilch from Capone. Now, she dated Thomas Ellery Evans. He was an American film producer, screenwriter, and actor. Evans is known for his work as a producer, and screenwriter in the mid 20th century in Hollywood. And he worked on a variety of films in different genres, like westerns, dramas, crime thrillers, the whole gambit. Then there was this other man by the name of Thomas Lee. He's kind of elusive. There isn't much information on him, but what is known is that he probably came from a troubled background. He was either an acquaintance or a boyfriend, but it's hard to tell. Then on October 7th, 1949, Spangler left home at 5 p.m. She was wearing a long white coat and white pants. She reportedly told her sister-in-law to wish her luck, while crossing her fingers before leaving Christine, her daughter, in Sophie's care. Sophie is her sister-in-law. Now, she called home a few hours later to check in on Christine. That was at around 7 p.m., actually. Past the early morning hours the following day, October 8th, Spangler was never seen again. Now, originally, Spangler told Sophie that she was going to meet with Benner, her ex-husband, regarding a late child support payment that she was going to work on a night shoot for a film right after. She told Sophie that, quote, she would have to work the full 8 hours and wouldn't be back that evening, which is interesting because if she was an extra, she would have had to work the full 8 hours regardless because extras get paid for eight. But extras get paid for eight. But that's also, of course, you know, of course, there are exceptions. So I guess there could have been exceptions there. Now, just to give you the full scope, Spangler's mom was also out of town. She was visiting family in Kentucky. So she wasn't even in L.A. during this. Then after failure to return, Sophie filed a missing persons report. Now, the police didn't do anything right away. They didn't even put her name on the teletype. The teletype is the TTY, which facilitated rapid communication over long distances. This was before email and instant messaging. And the police assumed that she was just out on the town, like most of the Hollywood type. They're like, she'd probably come back. Apparently, this wasn't all that true for Spangler, though. She was not known for disappearing for any reason or for leaving for long periods of time without checking on her daughter. And her mother said that she called without fail upon arrival and departure. So with regards to her boyfriend, all of her boyfriends, that is, plural, Spangler was, quote, very careful about her friends and would never deal with a stranger. So according to Benner, he hadn't seen Spangler in weeks. He had no meeting scheduled with her. His new wife of 1 month, I might add, Lynn Lasky, corroborated this, which a wife would, so whatever. But additionally, the SEG also confirmed that Spangler was not scheduled on a night shoot on October 7th. And then Central Casting confirmed that Spangler's just, she wasn't scheduled to work at all. So now they're kind of like, okay, I am confusion. What is happening? What the fuck? Now here are the known sightings. This is what we know-ish. At 6 p.m., a merchant at the local farmer's market near Spangler's home said she saw her browsing and said she appeared to be waiting for someone. This was at the time officially the last sighting of Spangler. But then there were others. 7 p.m. Spangler may have entered a restaurant called the Cheese Box on Sunset Boulevard, where it was believed she ate a hot dog with a male who was tall and clean cut and around 35 years old. At this time, Spangler calls home to ask about Christine. Spangler was allegedly also spotted in Griffith Park, which is 20 minutes away from the Cheese Box. Now, fast forward, 2 a.m., October 8th. She was spotted back at the Cheese Box by a DJ with two other men arguing. And when she tried to speak to the guests, one of the men waved him off, so he backed away. Then there was a final sighting at a nearby gas station. The attendant, Art Rogers, said he saw Spangler with an unknown man in a blue-gray convertible. Remember the color of that car. The attendant had apparently been told to fill up because they were going to Fresno. He saw who he believed to be Spangler slumped in the car. And when they took off, she yelled, get our license plate and call the police. Officers weren't able to locate the vehicle. Then the following day, October 8th, an employee at Griffith Park found a purse and it belonged to Spangler. In it was her lucky silver dollar and a handwritten note that said, quote, Kirk, can't wait any longer. Going to see Dr. Scott. It will work best while mother is away. The employee called the police. Now the park was 4,000 acres big. So they started the search. This was at the time the largest search in LA history, with 200 people searching on foot and on fucking horseback. To keep the public at bay, though, the police issued a weird ass statement stating that she suffered, quote, a slight illness, but will return shortly as soon as she felt better. Who will release this type of statement but the LAPD? Because, you know, if you go back to my Wineville chicken coop murders, fuck, if you fast forward all the way to fucking Murder Rap with Tupac and Biggie, LAPD stay not wanting to be in trouble. Like, that's just like. Them motherfuckers stay not wanting to be in trouble. They are always worried about their image because they have such a long storied image. They have a long storied history of corruption that anytime they're associated with any semblance of corruption that could lead to people suing them, they're like, we ain't do shit. I promise. Oh my God. Please go back to Wineville chicken coop murders. I mentioned, I keep wanting to call that lady Christine, and her name must be Christine, 'cause I keep wanting to call her that. But, the Wineville chicken coop murders in season one that I did with my sister, where we talked about the movie The Changeling with Angelina Jolie, and the LAPD was so desperate to, you know, not take a L basically, that they tried to force that poor woman to take a child that wasn't her child. When her child had been kidnapped, they brought her a random boy. It was like, it's him. And she was like, it's not. And they were like, yeah, it is. Fucking LAPD is a trip. Now, it's obvious this wasn't a robbery. I mean, anyone who knew Spangler knew that she never really had any money. The note was giving abortion, though, which at the time was very illegal. But what was interesting was that the note had a comma at the end, as if she was interrupted before she could finish the note. Now, they thought maybe the name was actually someone's last name, but then they thought no woman would address her lover by his last name, which is not true. I have fucked many a dude that, and I only call them by their last name, straight up. Sorry. So that's not true. I don't know if it just makes me feel like a drill sergeant. I don't know. You know, I'm partly Dom in spirit. So, but anyway, so also, where was she taking this note? Like, where was she taking this note? The lead detective, Thad Brown, had a bunch of fucking theories. Now, first, they need to figure out who Kirk was and who Dr. Scott was. And in the meantime, actor Robert Stack, my boy from Unsolved Mysteries, creepy trench coat, fog, you know, single solitary street lamp nigga, Robert Stack. He called the police after Spangler's disappearance, telling them that he saw a figure lurking by her apartment. While this is weird, what was weirder is that he was trying to gain access to one of the windows. Not Robert Stack, but the figure that he saw lurking by her apartment, which I'm like, Robert Stack, why were you there for so long? And then, I mean, he did now, so. But I'm just saying, like, why were you chilling around this lady house like this? Well, he was probably kind of fucking with her too, but I do find it strange that, but he dropped that little nugget to the police. Like, yo, you know what's weird is like, but he called and was like, he called that when he saw it though. So that kind of helps him a little bit. That was the night of October 7th. He was trying to, whoever it was trying to gain access to one of the windows. I find that very interesting. Don't you? Because my assumption is, let's put a pin. We've just putting pins all over the place. Look at us. We got us our own little murder board. Let me give me some red yarn. Let's talk about this. Well, okay. So if Robert Stack called the police after Spangler's disappearance, telling them that he saw a figure lurking by her apartment, that was the night of October 7th. She went missing the night of October 7th. What figure? And first of all, she lived with her mother and her sister-in-law. Wouldn't her sister-in-law have been at the house with the baby that night? Am I tweaking? Because that's just weird. And even if a figure was lurking around her apartment, is it possible the sister-in-law is now, the mother-in-law is out of town. The sister-in-law is babysitting his child. You know, and her husband's dead. So maybe she had her a little dip that night. She was like, you know what? I'm watching, you know, this child or whatever, but you should come over. You know, who knows? But I found that very interesting because I'm like, if he called and said that he saw that and that was on the night of October 7th and she would have already been gone after 5 p.m. So I just wonder, like, what is that about? And it's also very creepy. Okay, so now during this half-assed investigation, the police learned from actor Richard Cummings that she told him that she had a new lover that she was happy about, but it wasn't serious. And they figured that this man at first was this writer by the name of Peter Brooks, but then that went nowhere. Then they proceeded to search for the doctor, Dr. Scott, which feels pretty dumb. Considering no doctor performing an abortion would ever willingly admit to being a doctor that performs abortions. I think we can all agree on that. They were able to find a former med student, though, who had been performing back alley abortions, and he went by Scotty and Doc. He was never located or questioned. And this is likely because he came from a wealthy family. Now, for some reason, they start searching instead for Dr. Kirk, which I'm like, that's not what the note says. The note separates Kirk from Dr. Scott. So you're doing a lot. Because Dr. Kirk was apparently a doctor who performed abortions. And he was also known for making people disappear. He wasn't a magician. So now they're just running with this abortion thing, possibly. And so they figured that she was possibly with a rich man who did not want a child. Conveniently, one of her last two jobs was on the set of a movie called Young Man with a Horn, starring Kirk Douglas, the father of Michael Douglas. Now, Spangler's mother and her sister-in-law confirmed that Kirk Douglas was the only Kirk mentioned at home, and said that she did briefly date a man named Kirk. Apparently, he refused to come inside the home when he picked her up, so they could not officially identify him, but they also didn't even know what type of car he drove. Now, how Douglas heard mention of his involvement in the case is unclear, but either way, he called the police preemptively. The police found this odd because he did this a few days after the sighting, and they talked to him twice. First, he said he really couldn't remember her. He was a bit of a hoe, though. He remembered her as a, quote, tall girl in a green dress, and that he kidded with her on set. That's it. He also said that he was getting over the flu out in Palm Springs on October 7th. A likely story, but the police were satisfied. So Thad Brown also never spoke to Kirk personally. He was never an official suspect. And when it came to Spangler, she only really dated wealthy or successful men. So it's strange that she didn't mention exactly who he was to her. I think it's worth saying that at this time, Kirk Douglas was married. So, there's that. And he had only been in the game for 4 years. He had only been acting for 4 years. And the film he acted in with Spangler was his 10th movie. So, he had a major fucking success prior to the release of Young Man with a Horn, which, by the way, starred Lauren fucking Bacall. Then there was the Black Dahlia connection. Now, if you don't know what the Black Dahlia is, here's a brief summary. Back in January 1947, a young woman by the name of Elizabeth Short, she was known as the Black Dahlia. She was found dead in a vacant lot in Los Angeles. Her body had been mutilated and she was cut in half. Now, this murder wasn't just any crime. It was because it became a fucking media circus. Newspapers went wild with speculation, since sensationalizing the details of Short's life and her death. They dubbed her the Black Dahlia because of her dark hair and her style. Now, the LAPD launched a massive investigation, but despite all the leads and suspects, they never caught the killer. And everyone from ex-boyfriends to shady characters were considered, but nothing stuck. Decades later, the case still remains unsolved. It's basically like the fucking Jack Ripper of the 1940s in America, making it one of the most infamous cold cases in history. Now, people still obsess over it. There's always new theories and new suspects popping up all the time. And she wasn't the only one. Black Dahlia wasn't the only one, though. There was also Mimi Boomhauer. She was a wealthy widow of a linoleum magnate. And she was a socialite who ran into money troubles, possibly because of gambling problems. And Mimi started selling her assets, but was still partying and living it up. She went missing on August 18, 1949, and her purse was also found. But it was found in a phone booth with a note that said, "Police Department, we found this at a beach Thursday night." Her body was never found, and her case is still unsolved. Connections to the Black Dahlia murder and the Boomhauer disappearance fizzled a bit. But in an attempt to connect her to a serial killer, and in my opinion, quickly put this shit to rest, The Spangler disappearance would be connected to Jeannie French, who was also a bit player in the movies, and the murder of Gladys Kern, who was a wealthy real estate professional. Now, Boomhauer, French, and Kern were all women in their 40s. As well, either they were taken or they were like brutally murdered. There was no real connection, though, to the Spangler disappearance. One person to revisit, though, in this investigation was Benner, Spangler's ex-husband, who had apparently remarried to an ex-mobster's wife. He knew how to pick bitches. That's for sure. Lynn Lasky had been married to Ellie Lasky. He was an associate of Mickey Cohen. So now it's possible. It's probable. And that it probably, you know, honestly, it makes a little sense to start looking at the mob a little bit, because the mob was kind of acting like a fucking fool out there. You know what I mean? Like, the mob was doing what mob does. They were doing some mob shit. They were kind of acting up. So it really makes sense for them to actually start looking at the mob, because Spangler's connection to the mob wasn't just because of Lynn Lasky. It was also because she was friends with a Mickey Cohen associate by the name of Davy O'Ghoul. This is while she was working at the Florentine Gardens, which was a nightclub. She was a dancer there. And O'Ghoul had been seen with her in Palm Springs and in Vegas. O'Ghoul disappeared 2 days after Spangler disappeared. Now, Cohen is interesting because his organization was not women friendly. He was known to blackmail starlets. He was known for extortionist behavior. He historically and allegedly is the one who blackmailed Marilyn Monroe while she was in her affair with JFK. Now, Spangler's, her black book was a wealth of information into her dating life, but none of the names were publicly connected to her disappearance. And all of the police could say was that, quote, this girl really got around. But then there was another mob connection. Jack Dragna, who was considered the Capone of L.A. Dragna was kicking it with O'Ghoul leading up to October 7th. And since he was being indicted, it's likely he was being pressured to leave the country. Now, this created yet another theory that she was actually taken out of the country. Customs agents near the El Paso border were aware of the sighting, two men and a woman that looked like Spangler. And one source claimed that she was actually staying in their hotel. This led to a sighting in Mexico City, which would mean she was on the run, possibly from the mob. Since they were associated with Cohen, and Dragna hated all things Cohen, it's likely that he killed all three, meaning Dragna, O'Ghoul, and there was another associate, and then Spangler, and then buried them somewhere. She was connected to a former bagman named Johnny Stompantano. Now, this was an abusive, high-headed piece of shit. He was an asshole. He had once pulled a gun on Sean Connery, but Sean Connery disarmed him, and he threw his ass off set. He was later stabbed to death, not Sean Connery, but Stompantano. He was later stabbed to death by the daughter of the actress Lana Turner after he threatened to kill her, the daughter, Lana Turner, her mother, and her grandmother. So she stabbed his ass. She stabbed him in the stomach. So after all of this, Florence, Spangler's mother, she attempts to get the FBI involved by writing a letter to President Truman, but unfortunately, there was no confirmation that Spangler was abducted, which to me, the purse is a bit of a giveaway. You know, I've told you this before. We talked about this on Susan Cox Powell. A purse is a giveaway. You can't sit up here and say, oh, there's no indication of her being disappeared. Motherfucker, her purse was found in Griffith Park. No woman leaves their purse in Griffith Park. Not a soul. Not for no reason. I'm just leaving my purse right here in Griffith Park. What? Like, I personally believe that if you see a woman's purse anywhere, it is safe to assume that she's been abducted. Whether or not she's dead, that's up for debate, right? But we can assume that something bad has happened when a woman's purse is just somewhere in a fucking park. I don't think that that's an irrational assumption to make. And at the end of the day, the bigger issue too, there was no report of violence and there was no confirmation of her even crossing state lines. So at the same time, Florence is in a bitter custody battle with Benner, who was cited for contempt of court for not showing up to 14 scheduled court dates. Quote, following the decree of divorce, custody of the minor child of the parties was awarded to the defendant, who with the child resided in the home of her mother. In October 1949, defendant disappeared and her whereabouts are still unknown. Soon thereafter, custody of the little child was awarded to the plaintiff. At a hearing on December 16, 1949, it was ordered, pursuant to stipulation, that Mrs. Spangler, the natural grandmother of the child, in whose home she had lived for 3 years, might have reasonable opportunities to visit with the child, and that the court might fix the times and places of such visitations, which the court did. Plaintiff has since moved to vacate the order of December 16, 1949 upon the ground that the court lacked jurisdiction to make it. For the order entered August 7, 1951, denying the motion he appeals, he has also given notice of an appeal for certain other orders entered August 20, 1951, charging him with contempt for alleged violation of the court orders regarding Mrs. Spangler's visitation privileges with the child. As to these latter orders, plaintiff is not aggrieved since his motion to dismiss the contempt citations was granted. Such purported appeal is therefore dismissed. Plaintiff attacks the order of December 16, 1949 on the ground that since Mrs. Spangler, the natural grandmother, was not a party to the action, the court has no jurisdiction to permit her to visit with the child in her own home 1 weekend per month from Saturday noon till 6 p.m. Sunday, and to visit with her in the plaintiff's home on Saturday in each month for 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. The simple answer to this attack is that the visitation privileges were granted pursuant to stipulations and for the best interest and welfare of the child. It was at this hearing that the court determined plaintiff was a fit and proper person to have custody of the child. He, having been awarded only temporary physical custody some 2 months previously, it is thus clear that the court has jurisdiction of the child and plaintiff, and the responsibility of determining what was for the best interest of the child, taking into consideration the absence of her mother, her age of about 4.5 years, that she had lived with her grandmother approximately 3 years, the father's remarriage and home situation, and the other facts and circumstances that appear to have a bearing on the problem and the proper solution. Her grandmother undoubtedly occupied an important place in the life of this young child in view of the absence of her mother and the fact that she had lived with the grandmother for some 3 years. To have suddenly severed the close blood tie of love and affection and completely removed the child from a familiar surrounding might well have caused her considerable nervous and emotional disturbance. Hence, the propriety of the order, which permitted the child to go back to her former home once a month and spend a day and night there, and to have the opportunity of spending an additional day each month in her new home with her grandmother. During the course of the hearing, plaintiff took the position that this order amounted to an award of custody of the child to the grandmother. Such a contention is contrary to the plain language of the order and its obvious intent. Of course, the court had the power, without the stipulation, to make an order which, from all the facts, appeared to be for the best interest and welfare of the child, and without regard to the personal feelings and desires of the father. In concluding his brief, plaintiff says this court should reverse the order denying the plaintiff's motion to strike her, Mrs. Spangler's, name from the files and records, and it does not appear that such an order was made in the court below, nor that such relief was within the scope of plaintiff notice of motion. There is therefore nothing in the respect of the court to pass upon, and the order entered August 7, 1951, denying plaintiff's motion to set aside and vacate the order of December 16, 1949 is affirmed. Just to spice things up, the court would later say that Benner's marriage to Lynn Lasky was invalid because it's hard to tell the time frame of the divorce decree. Benner received a 15-day sentence in jail for contempt, but fled to California and went to Florida with Christine. This doesn't make Benner look good. I have a theory. Now, I'm going to continue, though. Now, later attempts were made to connect Spangler to George Hodel, which I'll eventually do an episode on him because I know a lot about him. And he's fucked up. By former LAPD officer, detective, that is, Steve Hodel, who's actually the son of George Hodel, who thought that he was responsible for the Black Dahlia murder. He had a book called Black Dahlia Avenger, where Steve Hodel advances the theory that his father was responsible for the brutal death of Elizabeth Short in 1947, as well as the killings of Jeannie French, Gladys Kern, and possibly others, including Jean Spangler. The only tangible clue in the Spangler's case was her purse, which was discovered near Dr. Hodel's home, the Franklin House in Los Feliz, Los Angeles. Hodel recounts an anecdote from his half-brother Duncan, who remembered a stunning actress by the name of Jean, whom their father was dating at the time. Steve Hodel suggests that his father may have been with Spangler on the night she visited and on the night that she vanished, and speculates that she might have threatened to expose his secrets to the authorities. Now, Jean Spangler's last public appearance was at that Hollywood restaurant, the Cheese Box, where she was seen arguing with a man resembling George Hodel. The confrontation, witnessed by the popular DJ Al the Sheik Lazar, occurred in the early hours of October 8th. Another witness, restaurant owner Terry Taylor, reported seeing Spangler with a well-groomed man on October 7th, just before George Hodel was arrested on charges related to his daughter's accusations of molestation and abortion. Steve Hodel also alleges that his father was involved in providing illegal abortions to the affluent with a network that included a figure known as Dr. Fucking Scott. He contends that this is a clandestine operation involving paying off law enforcement, which, duh. Remember the station attendant? He said on the same evening that Jean Spangler was spotted at the Hollywood restaurant, he encountered a man and a woman resembling Spangler at the gas station near the Sunset Strip, where the man purchased the gas, and then Rogers recalled the woman who matched Spangler's description, shrinking down in the passenger seat and telling him to call the police or follow the car. There's been two different stories there that she either said, call the police, take down the plate, or that she said, have the police follow this car. But despite Roger's quick notification of the authorities, by the time they arrived, the couple had already gone. And Steve Hodel firmly believes that the man seen with Spangler was his father, not only because of his description, but because he owned a 1936 black Packard sedan. Now, two sources I read said that this car was black. One said that it was blue-gray. I don't know which one is true. This vehicle also corresponds to witness accounts of the car leaving the scene of Elizabeth Short's murder in 1947, which was documented by the LA Examiner, where they published a map entitled it Black Sedan Hunted in Los Angeles as Death Car. Hodel maintains his conviction that his father was involved with Spangler on the night of her disappearance. Quote, it's my belief that she started dating Dad either September or early October. In his relentless pursuit of the truth about his father, Hodel obtained clearance to search Franklin House in 2012 in hopes of finding forensic evidence. And during the search, a trained dog detected the scent of human remains in the basement and the area behind the house. Subsequent soil and analysis confirmed the presence of human remains in the soil samples recovered. George Hodel was never formally charged or convicted in connection with any of the crimes, and he was suspected of committing. He passed away in 1999, leaving behind a legacy shrouded in mystery and intrigue. According to an article I read on MamaMia.com, LAPD homicide detective Rick Jackson, who fielded inquiries about the case during his career, told Entertainment Weekly that he believes Spangler was killed. Nothing, he said, quote, nothing I've ever read about indicated that she skipped town. People generally don't do that kind of thing unless there's a motive or a unique set of reasons. Obviously, she cared for her daughter enough to get custody back. It just makes sense that she was met with foul play. There's no doubt she was dead. That's why she never surfaced. A dark Hollywood hit mystery that, just like Spangler's note, is missing its ending. Jane Spangler's disappearance remains unsolved. Now, what's my theory? My theory is that Miss Jane Spangler got knocked up, possibly by Kirk Douglas. Actually, definitely by Kirk Douglas. It's on the note. Let's be fucking for real. Kirk is a popular name, but not really. Like, think about it right now. How many motherfuckers you know named Kirk? I know two Kurtz, like as in Kurt Russell, but I don't know a lot of Kirk, K-I-R-K. I don't know a lot of the motherfuckers. I think she got knocked up by Kurt. And I think because if you know anything about George Hodel, which you don't, and you will, because I will do an episode on him, you'll know that George Hodel, like his son said, he got into a lot of Hollywood shit. Let's just say he was Diddy. Is that safe? Yeah, that's safe. He was like Diddy, except he exercised black magic a little bit. And I think George Hodel was probably enlisted to perform this abortion, probably from either a studio or Kirk Douglas himself or Kirk Douglas's manager. Because this is what I do know about Hollywood. If you have a budding star, somebody like Kirk Douglas, who's already being nominated for shit, he's already doing big movies, he's only been in the game for 4 years, he's good at his job, he's great. Studios back then owned actors. They would have them sign deals, contracts, big contracts. And a studio representative would make sure that a person like Kirk Douglas would not fuck that up. So in the publicity sense, Kirk Douglas is married. Kirk Douglas gets a random extra pregnant. That means that Miss Jean Spangler is going to have to get an abortion. She got to. Ain't no choice, right? She says, I don't want to. He says, how much would it cost for you to do that? She gives him a number. She tells a homegirl, oh, you know what? I may be coming into some money soon. I'm super excited. She goes to get the abortion, or at least thinks she's going to get the abortion. Now, when it comes to get the abortion, she could have either died on the abortion table, which is incredibly likely, getting a back alley abortion, you know, when fucking abortions are illegal, or she could have been a part of George Hodel's creepy sacrificial ceremonies, or she could have made it when she was slumped over on that, in that gas, at that gas station. She was probably achy from the abortion, and they decided they weren't going to pay her shit. Because she got a big fucking mouth. And she'll do anything for money. And if you talk to a person like Jean Spangler for the right price, she'll sing like a fucking canary. I think once they completed the abortion, There's a likelihood that exchange or that deal didn't turn out the way they thought it was going to. Well, specifically, Jean's didn't think it turned out. Well, Jean didn't have it turn out the way she wanted to. She probably thought she could just even exchange the shit. They give her the money and she moved the fuck on. But they realized what type of woman Jean was. Jean probably talks too much. So after the abortion, they realized that she wasn't a woman you could really negotiate with. And they probably killed her. And they probably dumped her body somewhere that it could never be found. My guess is probably somewhere in Griffith Park. And since it's 4,000 acres, I can see it being hard to find it. Especially in the 40s. I think if a real search effort was put into it in, you know, 2024, maybe they could do like some, you know, I don't know, some overhead camera shit to see if there's any like heat. It wouldn't be heat at this point, but just see if there's like any human bodies anywhere. But it's massive. It's expansive. My mother lives near Griffith Park. And Griffith Park Observatory is in Griffith Park. They wouldn't really want to draw any attention to that. And then at some point, the studios got involved and they told the press to just say that she was sick. Because Kirk Douglas is involved. So just say that she's sick. We'll get back to you after these messages. The mob connection is pretty. Mob connection is convenient, but I don't think that's the one. Whether it was Hodel, I mean, if Steve Hodel is right and he had a Dr. Scott on his payroll, it could have been that Dr. Scott who was the medical student. I mean, Hodel didn't give a fuck. Hodel didn't have limits. He fucked kids and animals. He didn't have limits. So, to me, there is a likelihood that that is what happened. That exchange didn't happen. Now, as far as that note, it could be that originally she was going to drop that note off to Kirk, wherever he is or wherever he lives, whatever. And she realized that he was in Palm Springs. And maybe she didn't complete the note. I don't know. I don't know where that goes. Why her note ended in a comma does shows a lack of completion, which means that either she has something to say and didn't feel the need. Well, she kept the note, too. But it depends on where she wrote the note. They could also, you know, forced her to write the note at the cheese box. I don't know. This can go either way. This is one of those problems when, unfortunately, being a woman is dangerous, especially if you spend your time with a lot of seedy men, especially when you try to flex and, you know, when you try to flex and extort powerful men with your body, whether it be with through sex or abortion. It's a slippery slope. Because I think most women know that men are willing to kill you. You know, I was watching, I think I mentioned this on a previous episode. Louis C.K. made the joke. Louis C.K. was like, it doesn't matter what men do to women. Women will always still seek men. Men are one of the biggest safety hazards to women. And that does not keep women from wanting to be with men. So for her, because of the lifestyle she led, it could literally go anyway. Literally. That woman could have, it could be Kirk Douglas. I'm pretty sure it's Kirk Douglas. And who knows? I mean, she lied to everybody. That's the big, excuse me. That's the biggest issue too. I you know, I've told my little sister this, and I do this in my personal life. My mother may not know what's going on in my life, who I'm fucking, who I'm going to quickly go see, who, you know, any of that other shit. She may not know all of that, right? But my mama, I mean, but what, somebody gonna know. If I'm going to see a dude, somebody gonna know. Dustin gonna know, Sal gonna know, my sister gonna know, somebody gonna know. I'm not about to sit up here and become a cold case because I was trying to keep a motherfucking secret. Okay, I can keep it from my sister, but somebody gonna know. I can keep it from my mama, but somebody gonna know. I'm gonna tell you right now. You plan on killing me, you best believe I already dropped the pen, baby. That shit is already sent, my guy. I don't read all this shit for no reason. You hear me? So when I think about things like this, I think if you don't take anything else from this, and if you're a young person or even an old person and you like dipping off of random motherfuckers, tell someone. Don't lie like this. Because we would know where Jean Spangler is possibly, or her murderer would have been brought to justice had she fucking told somebody where she was going. Don't keep secrets like that. Mm-mm. Do not. You fucking some random dude and he got you somewhere in his house, or you going out of town to see him, you drop that fucking location. Absolutely. And we want the full name, government. We don't want no nickname. I want his birthday. I want to know who his mama is. I need specifics. Because at this point, we've learned that men are dangerous to women, unfortunately. Things can go south very quickly. All it takes is a bad mushroom, a bad pill, too much alcohol. And you can end up raped and buried in somebody's backyard. So, if you don't learn anything else from this motherfucking episode, you got a homegirl that you can trust with your life. You tell her where the fuck you are going. Okay. Cool. All right. Thank you for joining me for episode 11. This is the mysterious disappearance of Jean Spangler. I'll see you all in 2 weeks. And we're going to talk about some more shit. You feel me? Thank you all for everything. Thank you for listening to this. If you listen to this bi-weekly, thank you for FeedSpot for putting me on that top 20 list of most inappropriate podcasts on the web. I'm so excited about that. And thank you to all of the people I've met on TikTok who are engaging in this podcast, and people who have fallen into me from Instagram. I appreciate y'all too. I really, really appreciate you. If you want to find me on Instagram, I'm Swear to Drunk Podcast on Instagram. I'm also Lavender and Bordeaux on Instagram. That's my personal one. If you want to find me on TikTok, you can find me on at Sting Like a Bee. B-E-A as in B Arthur, not the bzz bee. Cool. All right, cool. Y'all have a good week. Peace.